new program to bring down violence in the city kicks off in Duval. Meanwhile, a school funding plan gets pushback, and another city agency is accused of not operating in the sunshine. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, all of the top stories of the week with our Friday Roundtable. You can join us right now. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, don't miss our conversation with comedy legend Weird Al Yankovic, a preview of his upcoming performance this weekend at the Amp in St. Augustine. That's ahead, too. But first, this hour, it is Friday, and here to discuss a very busy week in the news, we welcome Nate Monroe of the Florida Times Union. Good morning.
Good morning.
Mike Mendenhall of the Jax Daily Record is here.
Good morning.
Freelance journalist Claire Goforth.
Happy Friday.
And Ann Schindler of First Coast News.
Hey, Melissa.
What a great foursome here. Guys, thanks so much for joining us, because there's a lot to go over this week. Everything from new sunshine law issues for Jacksonville to how we're going to fund local school improvements and more. But our top story this morning, the city's new efforts to bring down violent crime rates. The nationally regarded program Cure Violence kicks off this weekend in Jacksonville. Specially trained young people with criminal pasts hit the streets in some of the city's most violent zip codes. And the idea is that they'll build relationships at the grassroots level to divert people from lives of crime. Now, at the same time, the city's new Task Force on Crime and Safety Reduction came out with its preliminary report Wednesday. They're recommending up to $2.7 million for youth programs like mentorship, teen programming, and juvenile justice to try to bring down crime rates. Cure Violence is costing the city just under $800,000 for its first year. So we're going to begin the hour with a closer look at Jacksonville's efforts to address gun violence, homicide, and crime with your calls at 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org and tweets to @MelissaInJax. Ann Schindler, let's begin with Cure Violence. This is a program that has been operating in other cities with a violent crime issue like Chicago, Baltimore, the West Coast, other places. Can it work in Jacksonville?
Well, that's the hope.
I guess that's the hope.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, I think that one thing that gives it some strength is the fact that it's got the buy-in of the mayor and the sheriff and the state attorney's office. And I don't think we should diminish the significance of that. You know, these are people who are in positions to know when retaliatory violence is coming down the pipe. And particularly when, you know, we hear about an incident, whether it's like the shooting at the Landing or the Christmas Day shooting that was on the east side, you know, we hear about that as a news item. But the people who are, you know, in law enforcement know that there is payback coming, and they monitor social media as they're building their cases, and they know that there are threats coming back and forth. They very often can pinpoint with some specificity when something is going to go down. And if they are invested in, you know, that trying to stem the violence, trying to stop the retaliation before it occurs, they can really be important players in that. So if their buy-in is important, and the fact that they're supporting this new approach to dealing with crime is significant.
Yeah, it is a new approach. Mike Mendenhall, the idea is to treat this as a public health issue, as if you were controlling the outbreak of disease by stopping violence, interrupting the cycle of violence before it starts.
Yeah, that's right. You know, the idea of sending these trained mentors who have experience and who, some of them who have backgrounds being exposed and a part of violent crime themselves, it really it's a unique idea, and it's a way to gain trust with the people in those communities and the city itself they really seem to be going all in on this.
Nate Monroe, let's talk about the funding. Meanwhile, as Cure Violence is getting funded for 1 year as it sort of pilots in Jacksonville at about $750,000, at the same time, a city task force on violent crime reduction is recommending $2.7 million for other efforts to improve public safety in the city of Jacksonville.
Yeah, well, the problem has become one of such magnitude that it certainly can't be ignored. I think
The last time I looked yesterday, we were at 69 homicides for the year. Mm-hmm. That's pretty dramatically outpacing last year. And, you know, the catch is going to be, as it always is, that there is no dedicated revenue stream to fund children's programs. The Cure Violence program, you know, Cure Violence is going to work. There will be a reduction in violence in these targeted neighborhoods, but it only works as long as it's funded. And, mm-hmm. you know, the Kids Hope Alliance, the sort of newly created umbrella group that handles these kids programs, it is every year relies on this discretionary amount of money it gets from the city instead of having, like a lot of other such organizations in other counties, a guaranteed knowable amount it's going to get every year. And so, yeah, it's great that they're giving more money, but, you know, the next time that there's a downturn in the economy and when city finances shrink, this is the first stuff that gets cut.
Right. We've seen this before, Claire Goforth. The Jacksonville Journey Initiative was a really well-funded, comprehensive look at addressing all of the root causes of violent crime in Duval County. It lost funding. And so this question keeps coming up. Does Jacksonville need a dedicated funding source for these kinds of efforts?
I would say clearly that it does need a dedicated funding source. This is not a new issue in Jacksonville. We've been struggling with murder and violence for many years. So without a dedicated funding stream, however the political winds blow, will determine whether or not this program continues. Meanwhile, there are other factors that do need to be addressed in Jacksonville and nationwide as far as economic opportunity, the incarceration system. I mean, you keep locking people up and you have them in these distressed areas without any means of employment in food deserts, and then ask yourselves how they end up in a life of crime. Well, I mean, it's pretty easy to see why.
You know, as you pointed out a minute ago, Anne, the police track a lot of this stuff on social media. And now what they will have, at least in the short term, are peacemakers or violence interrupters, as Cure Violence calls them, who can build trust in communities where this is the most serious issue. It's interesting to look at how other cities have dealt with Cure Violence. They've tried it. Some cities haven't continued with it. And so that's certainly something we might want to think about for Jacksonville. You could see the city potentially saying after a couple of years, well, we're not going to pay for this anymore, as the others here have said.
Yeah, I mean, the commitment is going to be a question. And there's going to be this year-long period. And I mean, I think you had one of your guests this week on your show, Melissa, said they were projecting a 50% crime drop.
That's right.
Optimistic, but
yeah, it's an ambitious goal. Like Cure Violence is saying, we're going to bring down crime rates 50%.
But I think the fact that the task force report kind of dovetailed with the launch of this week is interesting, because I think what that shows is that the solutions to the problem of violent crime aren't a real mystery. The task force recommendations are basically the boilerplate recommendations that every, you know, 6 or 8 years we sort of revisit and say, well, wouldn't it be great if we did this early intervention stuff? Wouldn't it be great if we had better resources for kids before they get caught up in cycles of violence? And so the solutions are not out of reach. They really do just require the investment, the foresight, and the willingness to sort of, you know, begin before problems manifest. And it's easier than interrupting violence, you know, if you are able to give kids opportunities when they're
right.
young.
Right. I mean, the Cure Violence approach is putting out a raging fire. The long-term approach is creating conditions so that the fire doesn't start in the first place. Nate.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, the Cure Violence, you know, these violence interrupters don't go in and tell these young men, you know, to pull up their pants and to stop smoking pot and to like get their lives together. They're there for the shootings. They're there to stop the shootings, and that's it. And, you know, potentially the city can get a really nice bit of breathing room to actually invest in the kinds of programs and, to Claire's point, infrastructure and you know, some other things that might help with the really deep disparities in this town. If they don't take the opportunity to do that, though, and that's really always kind of Jacksonville's weakness, then this is all kind of for naught.
And when you say this is Jacksonville's weakness, you mean
investing in
not
itself.
Not investing in itself.
Yeah. Yeah, that's always exactly. That's always the thing that the city falls short on. And that's, you know, this crime task force. I mean, yeah, there's nothing new in this report. It was we did it because, you know, there was an election coming and, you know, there was a really bad spate of violence and it looked like we needed to do something. So here we are.
Mike. And I'll be curious to see if there are any conflicts between the police and the Cure Violence people, because if the police want to take somebody in, are they going to be necessarily willing to let Cure Violence come in to sort of try to defuse the situation? I'm not 100%. I don't know that we all have faith that police are going to be willing to give leniency in those kind of situations. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out.
Well, and the city has a clear incentive, too, to make sure that this program works properly. I mean, you look at the emphasis right now about bringing in larger businesses, development, those kind of things. A lot of these companies that want to come in and invest in Jacksonville, they're concerned about violent crime. They're concerned about, you know, those kind of things in neighborhoods. And I mean, we're not just talking downtown, too. I mean, a lot they're trying to push renewed investment in Arlington. They're trying to push renewed investment, you know, and elsewhere in the community. And that's going to be a sticking point for a lot of these employers who want to bring people here.
Let's go to your calls now. What do you think of the new Cure Violence initiative for Jacksonville and other efforts to address violent crime in Duval County? It's 549-2937. Let's go to your calls. Bob is in Atlantic Beach. Hi, Bob. Good morning.
Good morning. I think Cure Violence will work, but I also think we have to have follow-on programs to follow Cure Violence. For example, I work with Florida Youth Maritime Training. We provide vocational training to people who were, for example, ex-felons, to work in the maritime industry. Because of the training, they go out and they get jobs. We've trained over 165 people, have about 150 employed, with an average salary of about $37,500. If you're earning money like that, you're much, much less likely to become involved in street violence. And I think the city needs to expand its program a little bit. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. As we mentioned, this city task force on crime and safety violent crime reduction is recommending nearly $3 million toward youth programs. But as several of you have pointed out, that's not a dedicated funding stream. That's a one-time allocation of funds, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, that is the missing puzzle piece, I think, for finding solutions at the early stages of, you know, our violent crime problem.
What about the other side of the argument? Now, as you pointed out, Nate, the city has a reluctance to invest in itself. And we've all interviewed officials who say, well, we just can't afford a dedicated funding source for this.
I mean, Jacksonville has lower taxes like across the board than our peer cities in Florida, than peer cities around the country. You know, like, does anyone going to argue that like Tampa is not outpacing Jacksonville in quality of life issues? I mean, they are. That's ridiculous. I mean, that's just the local politicians just don't want to be in a position where they're asking voters to implement tax increases.
But they always find money to give economic incentives to their rich buddies, to the donor class. I mean, I think that you look at the numbers and the many millions of dollars that we just pour into people who are going to put up some apartments. And then you say, well, you know, maybe we can come up a couple hundred thousand for Cure Violence for now. We'll see how it goes. You know, it's this top-down approach that has not been working and will continue to not work.
Jack in New Haven. Where's New Haven, by the way? Is there a New Haven anywhere in town? Hey, Jack.
New Haven, Connecticut.
You're calling from Connecticut?
Yes, I'm listening through the NPR app.
Oh, wow. Well, thanks for listening all the way from New England. Good morning. What's the weather like up there?
Good morning. It is sunny and 70 degrees.
Oh, Jack, did you have to rub that in? Okay, so what are your thoughts about this?
Yeah, I'm really happy to hear about this program, but I must say I don't really know much about it. So my question is I'm wondering, you guys were talking a little bit about the big picture influences on violent crime, like income inequality. And I know from living and working in several neighborhoods in my time in Jacksonville that there, it really is like two different cities. When you go from the south side and then go to like east of Jacksonville, some other places. So I'm just wondering what this program does to specifically target those larger economic issues, as well as, I mean, I'm very glad to hear about the pragmatic stopping of violence while it happens, but I'm wondering what its ideas are for addressing income and income inequality in Jacksonville, things like that.
Yeah. And I think that's what we've been talking about throughout. Exactly. Thanks for that call all the way from New Haven, Connecticut.
Cure violence doesn't do anything to fix those larger problems.
Right. As we said, it's addressing the immediate issue. Right. It's not getting at the root causes of the issue.
It's a tourniquet. You know, that's what it is. And, you know, it's not like the Get Well program.
John is in Ortega. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, this is John. I think our culture believes in violence. I think the police believe in violence, and I think the kids are taught to believe in violence, and I think we glorify violence on television and on. I was recently assaulted, and I've been practicing nonviolence for many years, and I took a hush puppy off of a buffet at a restaurant, and it was turns out it was a private buffet. I didn't know that, and I was grabbed by the throat by someone. I didn't see him coming, and my larynx was injured. And I insisted that the restaurant call the police because I'd been assaulted. And when the police got there, this happened in Jacksonville. When the police got there, they told me they would have done worse to me if I'd taken food off of their plate. And I said, it wasn't a plate, sir. It was a buffet. I could barely talk. I was aghast. And I just think we believe in violence. I think we need to go to something fundamental. Police need to be trained in nonviolence, and they're not. They carry big guns, and they're trained to shoot them so they don't get killed.
John, thanks for the call. And, you know, we are a violent society. We do have a huge issue with gun violence in America. People from other countries don't have this issue. The big difference between America and other developed countries is easy access to deadly weapons. And that's simply, and as he pointed it out as well, we glorify violence in this country.
Well, we do incarcerate people at a much higher rate than other countries. And I think that one thing that we lose sight of in our push for law and order is how much of a hole that creates in the communities when people are incarcerated. You know, it's not just the father going to jail, it's the kids, it's the wife, it's, you know, the families left behind that are, you know, economically strapped and also, you know, lose an important part of their family structure. So, you know, when we are pushing for more law enforcement, we also need to be cognizant of the fact that that has a lot of impacts on the communities left behind.
And also too, I mean, with the Cure Violence program, it's a cumulative effect. I mean, and once if there is a dedicated funding stream that's put out for this program, there's just one part of a larger solution. And you're going to need to fund other programs. I know Scott Wilson, after he was named the council president designate the other day, told me that one of his initiatives is going to be to fund or bolster mentoring programs for at-risk youth. In Jacksonville, there was no concrete idea attached to that statement, but again, those things were going to need funding.
And if you're just tuning in, as we talk about the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable, we're going to shift gears now and touch on some other headlines from the last several days. The number to join us is 549-2937. Okay. Also making headlines this week, a powerful group of local CEOs is criticizing the school board's plan to shore up Duval's aging school buildings, even though some of their concerns appear to be misplaced. The Jacksonville Civic Council sent a letter to Duval Superintendent Diana Green this week, laying out all of their issues with the $1.9 billion proposal the school board is looking at to fix up aging schools around town. Duval has the oldest school buildings in the state, and this is also the only large school district in the state that is being forced to go through city council approval to ask the public to vote up or down a half-cent sales tax proposal to address this issue. Now, the Civic Council praised the idea of consolidating some school campuses, but they say the district isn't factoring in the growth of charter schools into their planning. The district says that's just not accurate. Nate Monroe, you wrote a column about this. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, the Civic Council is an interesting group. It, you know, especially on the topic of concerns about the expense of these major efforts, the Civic Council signed off on the mayor's the changes to the city's retirement system a few years ago. That will cost taxpayers like twice as much as what the school board is seeking, like billions of dollars, like $4 billion. And that only all because we're going to take longer to pay off pension debt. Now that we're talking about school construction, you know, the criticism is that, oh, you know, there's going to be too much spending per pupil. You know, the council is recommending the school board build public schools down to charter school standards, which are more relaxed and cheaper. Aside from being a kind of tone deaf thing, I think for a group of mostly white old CEOs to say, you know, if I'm a school board member, you know, I'm looking at what happened in South Florida. The school resource officer was charged with crimes for failing to protect students. I'm not going to build a public school building to a specification, anything other than what the consultant that we hired told us to, because there are, you know, unfortunately, there's just a huge issue with school safety now. And there's obviously like the hurricane standards that public school buildings have to meet.
Yeah, I mean, the public schools are held to a more stringent standard. And at the same time, as you and others have reported, as all of this is playing out and pro-charterization forces like the CEOs on the Civic Council are throwing up criticisms of spending close to $2 billion to repair all these school buildings, kids all over the city were ending the school year without air conditioning. And so that gives you an idea of how badly disintegrating some of these buildings are. They don't, a lot of them don't have air conditioning anymore that works well.
Those are the buildings too that during hurricanes are you know, typically used as evacuation resources for the community. So they are supposed to be, you know, built to a level that can withstand and be durable. And I think that school safety is also a big deal. But, you know, the school board is in a difficult position right now where it's, you know, because of this decision from the general counsel that it doesn't have the authority to pursue this tax on its own without city council, you know, co-signing it. It's really gutted its authority. It's really gutted its purpose in a lot of ways. I mean, you sort of, you take away the taxing authority of an elected school board, you sort of defanged them. And so, you know, they're almost going hat in hand, it seems like, with needing the approval of Civic Council and the council itself.
Right. The only school district in Florida that's being put in this position, having to ask the city council for approval and also dealing with blowback from an unelected body of business leaders, most of whom are pro-charter and have interests in the charter, some of whom have interests in the charter, financial interests in the charter school industry. And so, you know, as we watch this play out, by the way, we want your calls on this. Do you support or oppose the school district's idea to have a referendum, a half-cent sales tax referendum on paying for school repairs in Duval County? The number is 549-2937. So Superintendent Diana Green was hired here from her previous job on the other side of Florida because she had successfully done something like this in her previous job. But she didn't have the challenges that she has now in Jacksonville in terms of the city's top lawyer writing this opinion, which has been criticized as legally dubious, forcing her to go through city council approval. And she's also facing this strong blowback from the so-called donor class, who isn't in favor, it seems, of this idea.
This idea has to be vetted by 27 politicians, like between the council, the mayor, and the school board. Like, that is just like a recipe for disaster. 27 politicians. Like, that's it doesn't make any sense. The general counsel has screwed this up royally. The school board should sue the general counsel or the city and challenge that interpretation if the city council
rejects their request. Do they have plans to do that?
I don't know. They should.
I mean, honestly, this issue dates back to the late 90s. You know, I remember Gwendolyn Gibson on the school board having a fight about, you know, we need our own general counsel. We can't rely on a shared general counsel. It doesn't give us autonomy. We're not able to function. And it really does tie the hands of one school district out of 67. It's a very unusual circumstance.
I mean, and this isn't the first time the Office of General Counsel has intervened and done whatever the mayor wants. I mean, let's be honest, Jason Gabriel is a supporter of Mayor Curry. I mean, that's very clear. And it just seems like this is a, you know, this comes from on high. And what's the point of electing a school board if they don't have authority to run the school system? I mean, I think they are the best position to know what the school system needs. City Council doesn't deal with these issues day in and day out. So why are we taking authority from them?
At the same time, the city's Charter Revision Commission is being put together, and there's been some rumbling, Mike Mendenhall, that once they met 10 years ago, and as they meet again, could they once again bring up the idea of changing the school board from elected officials to appointed officials? If that were to happen, then forces in this community that seek the further privatization and charterization of our school system, they would be in a better position to carry out that agenda.
Well, yeah, and from looking from the makeup of the Charter Commission, it appears that there's at least one member on there who is supportive of pushing more towards charter schools, and since there is a history in Jacksonville of bringing that to light, there is a definite possibility that that could come again. Kind of really quick, going back to the building standards too. One of the things that school district officials always have to keep in mind is, you know, that they, when they're trying to do a project, I mean, funding sources, they don't come easily. When you have to bond out, you have to plan 20 years in advance. You have to build a school that's going to last a long time, because you may not get that opportunity again for another 50 years.
Let's go to lots of calls now on this issue. Laura is in Arlington. Hey, Laura. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I have a lot to say. I'll be quick. I'm calling in support of the sales tax increase for schools. And I would express criticism for these business leaders who are trying to further the charter system at the expense of public schools. I used to work for one of the architectural firms that did the facility condition survey that is currently being publicized. And the situation in the schools is dire. We're talking fire code violations. We're talking safety issues. So something could happen at a school where children and staff get hurt. And then we're all going to ask, well, why was the building in this condition? And also, I work for a nonprofit that serves troubled youth, and this issue ties to your previous discussion about social inequality and crime, in that it's kids from low-income neighborhoods are going to failing and crumbling schools that furthers the issue of economic disparity and lack of opportunity. So Jacksonville really needs to wake up and tie these issues together and deal with it.
Thanks for that, Laura. Now, to give fair voice to the other side, proponents of making the terrain easier for charter schools say it gives parents in neighborhoods that have poorly performing schools an option, another choice, another way for their children. That's the argument for this.
Yeah, fine. I mean, three or four more charter schools in Duval County isn't going to fix the crumbling public school buildings that are here. I mean, I don't understand, like, you know, by all means bring in a charter school that you think is high performing, but there's still going to be kids going to these public school buildings, and there's still going to be this problem.
Anne on the north side. Hi, Anne. Thanks for holding. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. This is my first year teaching in Duval Public. I recently just moved here from Iowa, and it's just apparent to me that, like, how underfunded the schools are, and the infrastructure is crumbling. As a previous caller said, the outlets are faulty. There's desks that are falling apart. I still have chalkboards in my classroom. There's just major updates that have, I think, occurred across the nation that these schools and these kids have not been afforded to.
Where do you teach, Ann?
I teach in Duval Public Schools.
Okay. All right.
I don't really want to say, but
sure.
But the school is not big enough to hold the student population. You know, students have to eat off campus because the current facility isn't big enough to hold everybody. And so I hopefully when they do look at the re-infrastructure of the school, that they also consider safety and that open campus idea, incorporate all of that.
Yeah. The school, a lot of the schools are overcrowded. That's another issue. Thanks for that call.
I think you can't ignore the sort of socioeconomic, ethnic component to what's happening. You know, the pushback that Jacksonville sees. If you look just to our neighbors to the south, St. John's County, they successfully passed a dedicated tax for schools and school construction. And, you know, that's a community where you have a wealthy, largely white, affluent, you know, population that is sending their kids to these schools, wants to improve, build new schools, and they're very invested in their schools. And Duval County, which has seen, you know, its population flip to a majority-minority population, is you're seeing the people who are, you know, whose kids go to private schools, who perhaps live in St. John's County themselves, or who, you know, are vested in charter schools, pushing back against a plan to help schools that their kids don't go to.
Ann tweets the show, yes, we need the sales tax referendum. 70% are in favor of it. And if it doesn't pass, it will be the biggest fail in city history. Short-sighted. We won't be able to attract new business, and it'll be a major hit to property values. She's right. The Jacksonville Public Education Fund did survey respondents, and they found 70% or more are in favor of the sales tax referendum for schools. Madeline tweets the show, can't keep kids reasonably comfortable in school? Turn off the AC at City Hall and tell them no cooling until the referendum passes and watch what happens. Geez, she says, raise the tax, fix the schools, educate the kids. All right, Chris is on the south side. Hi, Chris. Good morning. Hey, Chris, you're on the air. All right, we will go to Lee on the west side. Hey, Lee, how are you? Hi, Lee.
Oh, hey. So look, I am against the tax simply because I don't believe we need any more taxes, but I imagine we are not the only county with these issues. And my proposal is simple, kill two birds with one stone, actually. Let's go ahead and legalize recreational marijuana, turn that into an industry, tax it like the cigarettes, and there's your revenue that you need to fix all the schools.
Thanks for that, Lee.
He's got a lot of faith in the people of Duval County to buy a lot of recreational marijuana, because that's what, I mean, how many billions do we need for the schools?
Yeah. I mean, other states have found a revenue source off cannabis, but yeah, we're talking about almost $2 billion.
Yeah, that would be a really interesting argument, though. I mean, let's make weed legal so that we can build schools for children. No one else sees the comedy in that.
It just sort of writes itself, that script.
Yeah. Jessica is downtown. Jessica, you're on the air.
Good morning. Yeah, I just wanted to agree with previous callers who have commented on the conditions of the public schools. I was really interested in sending my son to a gifted and talented magnet school. And when I toured the schools, I was appalled at, you know, the conditions of Andrew Robinson, R.L. Brown. These kids and the teachers are doing really great work when you tour the schools, but they're sitting here in what looks like old rundown warehouses getting this work done. I simply didn't feel safe sending my child to those buildings, and I was very, very sad that that's the condition that these quote-unquote gifted and talented schools are trying to operate in and attract new talent and staff and also students to. It seems absurd to me. You know, charter schools, you know, that's great. I understand they're an option for some people, but you know, when these civic, when the civic council leaders look to see why businesses are not locating here, one key issue that comes up over and over again is the poor quality of the public schools. Duval County regularly ranks very, very low in state and national rankings. And one of those huge issues is the conditions of the school. You can't properly teach or learn in a school that's crumbling.
Jessica, thanks for all those comments. And here's an email from Andy. In Neptune Beach, if the powers that be are determined to undermine and ultimately phase out public schools, they had better be prepared for a permanent underclass that will be stuck in poverty and violence and will affect their pristine country club world drastically. I guess the solution at that point would be a permanent wall between the two societies that result. That's some harsh words from him. But certainly some people perceive that the narrative is to starve the public schools of money and undermine public education as we have known it for these many years in the United States.
I mean,
I was going to say, people, like the previous caller said, people make housing decisions based on school systems, not only businesses, but individuals. When they decide where they're going to live, a lot of them, they're migrating to St. John's County because of their school system. Some people are in Nassau County because of their school system. You can actually improve the economy of Jacksonville by improving the school system of Jacksonville.
We're getting an email from a listener. She attended a school board meeting this week. Dr. Green told the group they have no plans to sue the city over this matter. It will be a waste of money they need, she said, to use for more important things. And so that is just something we wanted to get out to listeners. And we want to make note of another story that caught our eye this week. I know lots of folks are still waiting on hold to talk about schools, but let's talk quickly about an alleged sunshine law violation. This week, the Downtown Investment Authority Board apparently violated Florida's Sunshine Law when they anonymously turned in evaluations that were used to select new CEO Lori Boyer. Secret ballots violate the Sunshine Law, according to the state's First Amendment Foundation. And so as former Councilwoman Boyer prepares to lead the DIA, Mike Mendenhall, would this board be forced to vote again over this revelation?
I think they would only be forced to vote again if there is any type of legal challenge to it. However, if any legal challenge did find them in violation of the law, that vote could be null and void, and then they would have to do it again. I think I covered those interviews. I was in the room for 3 hours, and at the end, I think everyone in the room was expecting some type of either a roll call or at least to announce the vote totals from each of the individual members, and that never came. They just brought a piece of paper out and they said Lori Boyer is the new DIA CEO, and no one in the room really clearly questioned Councilmember Boyer's qualifications for the position. However, I think doing it in the open would definitely alleviate any misgivings that people would have.
I mean, I'm curious, what did they discuss why they were doing a secret balloting? Like, it seems very unusual. Was there any pre-discussion of that?
No, they have a sheet, and they rank on different specific areas. There's a numbered ranking that they have. So and then those numbers are tallied, and whoever at the end gets the most points is the DIA CEO. Yeah. Now, when they hired Andre Wallace, I believe it was back in 2013, those numbers were pretty much immediately made public. And in this situation, they just came out last night.
Okay. And Lori Boyer won the voting. She got a total of 356 points out of a possible 400. She bested the second place finisher, Greg Flizram, a senior VP for the Economic Development Corporation of Kansas City. So he was the board's second choice. They elected to go with a local person who'd served on the city council. And so she was the popular choice. And the question is, and let me just make the bigger picture comment that this is by far from the first time a city agency or a local government has had a problem with the Sunshine Law.
Yeah, it's not. I don't think it's that hard sometimes for agencies to run afoul of. I mean, what seems to be the problem in this case is that the city attorney who was at that meeting didn't call him out on it. But I would say that there's probably, if I were Lori Boyer and I was coming in, I would say, why don't we do this again, y'all? Let's have a vote. You know, I'm okay with it if you didn't vote for me, but let's put it out in the open. I think that would be a good message for her to send.
Yeah, I mean, no one doubts Lori Boyer's qualifications as a professional and as a public servant at all. But at the same time, I don't even know why they bothered to look for anybody else, because everybody knew that it was going to be her from the beginning. And that is kind of part and parcel of the way of Jacksonville, isn't it?
Well, you know what? I don't think that she felt that way.
Maybe not.
I ran into her before the vote was taken, and I asked her a few reporter-like questions. You know, how do you feel about your chances? And she said, you know, honestly, I'm really not sure. I don't think I have majority. I'm not sure I'm going to get this position. We'll have to wait and see. And, you know, in the end, it was a 10-point difference. And so there were good candidates from out of state, but you're right. The preference was for a local person.
Which is definitely understandable. Yeah. I'm just making the point, this is not the first time when there have been decisions that are being made and there's someone or a company that for a contract that is a shoe-in and everybody knows it, and they're a shoe-in because they're here and because of their relationships, not so much purely their qualifications. But again, Lori Borer, obviously qualified.
And, you know, we were talking earlier about the lack of a dedicated funding source and independent authority to deal with violent crime issues. The DIA was set up specifically to kind of address the issues with downtown development, Mike, a dedicated independent agency with its own money that can last through lots of different mayoral administrations to focus on this issue of building up downtown Jacksonville. And so leaving aside the Sunshine Law issue, that's what it's there for.
Well, yeah. And you need somebody who has an incredible knowledge of not only downtown Jacksonville, but of zoning laws, zoning regulations, of contacts with developers. And clearly Lori Borer has all of that. In the interview process too, when they were questioning the individual candidates, there was clearly some question as to whether or not Lori Borer could get past this possible ethical issue too that she had. There was some question because she's an elected official, and Florida ethics rules state that an elected official can't lobby a particular or a body that they served for at least 2 years. So there was some concern about that, because the previous DIA CEO, there were many situations where, you know, he went before the board and really helped explain the city council, really helped explain projects. So I think the vote was actually much closer than what I think a lot of people thought, because there were three people that favored Councilmember Borer. There were three people that favored Greg Flistrom from Kansas City. So there was definitely some hesitation on the board's mm-hmm. part.
All right. And really quickly, let's do a lightning round. We have a little extra time. What other stories caught your eye this week, Anne?
I've been working on like special projects, which is in my title. So I haven't been doing a lot of independent reporting. But one thing that I thought was interesting, all the TV stations kind of honed in on the interrogation tape of Ronnie Hyde. And what I thought was really interesting, just from my own perspective, watching that 5-hour interrogation, was the way that when he asked for an attorney, he sat with an investigator for 3 hours after he requested his attorney, spoke at length. And it was an interesting insight to me as a observer of okay. how those processes work.
Sure. Well, Claire.
Definitely the budget turkeys that Florida Tax Watch identified. Jacksonville actually had 20% of them. So I think what makes us the biggest turkey in the state.
And Mike.
I actually covered the Arlington downtown rezoning, Arlington overlay rezoning meeting. And the city is going, might actually offer a $20,000 grant program for improvements to some
Arlington. Okay. And last but not least, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from the week. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida. The Gilligan's Island edition, guys. This is just for you. Only in Florida would a 3-hour tour turn into a trip from hell, thanks to a Sarasota boat captain who was drunk. He essentially kidnapped the charter fishing crew and wouldn't take them home, and even fired his handgun into the air. Eventually, the scared passengers got within cell phone range and contacted the Coast Guard and made it home, finally. That scares me off of ever taking a charter fishing boat tour anywhere.
I like that it was because someone tried to steal one of his beers.
Don't do that. Thanks, Anne, Nate, Claire, and Mike, and have a great weekend, guys.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you.
Up next, Weird Al Yankovic.
New Horizons, offering IT programs designed to start your career in 3 months. Federal funding may be available. More information at newhorizons-jax.com or 564-9500. Wayne Hogan of the Tara Hogan Law Firm.
I'm Wayne Hogan. When crossing traffic lanes, be on the lookout for motorcyclists. For everyone's sake, the seconds you use to look might save a life.
Learn more at waynehogan.law.
In many areas, flood insurance prices have gone up dramatically over the last decade.
Everybody would love flood insurance if they can afford it, but there's not a person I know back behind our store community that was affected by this flood that can afford it. And they're all hardworking, good people.
That means some people hit by spring floods in the central U.S. are facing huge losses. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
I'm Ira Flatow. This week on Science Friday, treatment options for late-stage cancer can be limited, but new help may be on the horizon, coming from existing drugs. Plus, it's one of those mysteries of physics, the quantum leap. Have researchers managed to spot a jump in the act, saving Schrodinger's cat? On Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon at 3 here on 89.9 WJCT.
History made news this week. The 75th anniversary of D-Day, 30 years since the Tiananmen Square massacre, and a return to travel restrictions on Cuba. Congress mounts a bipartisan effort to block arms sales to Saudi Arabia. How will the Trump administration respond? And the Raptors are doing Canada proud in the NBA Finals. The Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Finally this hour, Grammy Award-winning comedy legend Weird Al Yankovic is in town Sunday night for a show at the Amp. I spoke with Yankovic about his incredible longevity in the music business and his unique place there. Take a listen. Weird Al Yankovic, what a pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you.
It's so exciting that you are bringing this show to the Amp. This sounds like an incredible show, by the way. It's called Strings Attached. You're going to be performing all of your hits, including background singers and a full orchestra. This sounds like a huge spectacle. It sounds amazing. How'd you come up with this idea?
Well, I was trying to think of different ways to mix it up and make it exciting. Last year, we did the Vanity Tour, which were basically me and the guys just going out on stage and playing our songs. Normally, mm-hmm. we do like costume changes and film clips and mm-hmm. props, and it's a major production. So last year was sort of our scaled-down version. And this year, we're doing our biggest extravaganza ever. So we're back to using the props and the costumes and the big LED video wall. And we're playing the hits, and on top of that, we've got background singers, and we've got a full symphony orchestra for every show. It's our biggest show ever, and it's very exciting.
It is exciting, and of course, you're a comedy legend. You're an icon. You're a Grammy winner, a string of gold and platinum albums. I didn't realize this, but only you and three other artists have charted every decade for the last four decades. The only other three to achieve that, the top 40, are Michael Jackson, Madonna, and U2. And you.
That's right.
It's incredible. I mean,
it's pretty crazy, yeah.
You know, I have been a fan for so many years, and it's just incredible how you hit upon this form of musical satire. And I know you've told this story many times, but how do you come up with the ideas for these songs? What sparks the process for you?
I just listen to the voices in my head. You know, there's no real process to it. You know, I'll get an idea for a song. Sometimes if I really know that I want to do a particular song as a parody, I'll come up with a bunch of different ideas. I generate dozens and dozens of ideas, and most of them are very bad ideas. But if I get lucky, one of them will be, oh, I can do something with that one. That one sounds kind of fun. It doesn't always work that way. Sometimes I'll try, and I can't think of an idea that I think is funny or clever enough, and then I have to, you know, move on. But if I get lucky, then I'll come up with an idea, and then I just kind of you know, work on that.
Not only are you a good musician and singer, you're a good actor, too, I think it's important to point out, because your videos are so funny and creative and fresh, and you're performing in the videos, which has played a big part in your success, too. What's it like doing the video piece of your work?
Well, it's a lot of fun. You know, obviously the recorded pieces have to stand on their own merit. But it's fun to be able to do a music video because then you're able to layer the comedy. Hopefully the music by itself is funny, but when you're doing video, you can do obviously visual humor. You can do even background gags. You can have several funny things happening at once. You can have things happening that you maybe you don't see on the first several viewings, but on the 20th time you go, oh, I didn't see that happening in the background. So it's a lot of fun to be able to, you know, add different layers to the comedy that way.
Now, you've talked about this a lot, too, in interviews, that you were a nerdy kid in high school, and you kind of found a way to turn that into a unique career. What's it like now for you as this icon? Kids that used to watch you in the 80s on MTV, now their kids are getting into your work. You've spanned the generations. Did you ever anticipate that when you started out?
No, that was certainly not calculated. That's just kind of a nice byproduct. It's nice to know that I'm played on family field trips and car trips and things like that.
Right.
When I look out into an audience at any given show, it's multi-generational. I mean, it's everybody from young kids to great grandparents, and they're all enjoying the show, maybe on a slightly different level, but they're all having a good time. And speaking to the thing about, you know, being weird, I mean, that's also something that was not calculated, but it turned out very well because I took on that name and, you know, I took ownership of my weirdness. That wound up being, I think, inspirational for a lot of other people that maybe weren't hip or popular or cool in their junior high school and high school years, and maybe they're a little nerdy or geeky, and other people made fun of them, but they looked at this guy named Weird Al who was empowered by his weirdness, and they thought, okay, well, maybe it does get better.
Exactly. It's an amazing message for so many kids to see how you are so comfortable in your own skin, and as you said, you own your weirdness and your talent. Because what you do, I think, has taken an enormous amount of talent, and longevity in the music business is so hard. So it's just incredible to see that you're coming here to town and going strong. And there are so many fans, I know, that are excited to come see you at the Amp. So, Al Yankovic, it is a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us, and have a great show.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
And a special treat right now, we have a pair of tickets to go see Weird Al this Sunday at the Amp. Email us now at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. We will pick one winner at random and let you know where to get your tickets. Here's a little more Weird Al for you. Enjoy. We'll see you Monday.
Too white and nerdy. MIT. Got skills, I'm a champion of D&D. MC Escher, that's my favorite MC. Keep your 40 out, just have an Earl Grey tea. My rims never spin, to the contrary, you'll find that they're quite stationary. All of my action figures are cherry. Stephen Hawking's in my library. My MySpace page is all totally...
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.